Hello, and welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is very fortunate to have with us as our guest author, USA Today bestselling author Mimi Matthews, whose new book, The Siren of Sussex, is just out and available in bookstores and libraries. Before we begin, I will pause briefly for a commercial message. The Poison Pen does have copies of The Siren of Sussex available, and we would be delighted to hold one for you or put one in the mail to you. Just give us a call or go online to The Poison Pen. Now, I would like to welcome Mimi Matthews.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here with you today.
We're delighted you could be with us too. My first question for you is, I'm always fascinated about authors and especially about who they were before they started writing. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself before you became an author?
Sure. So I started writing actually really, really young. I wrote my first book. I can't vouch for its quality at 13 and signed with my first agent at 18. But when that book didn't sell, and then I wrote a book after it, which was a totally different genre because I was just so young and I had no idea of, you know, writing to genre. I just didn't write fiction for a long time. I went to college and law school, I traveled, I worked. And it wasn't until I had a really bad neck injury. I had, from a car wreck, I had a multi-level cervical fusion and it broke, which left me bedbound and in pain and depressed. And I couldn't do all the things I normally did. And that's what brought me back to writing fiction. So I did it to occupy myself while I was recovering as best I could. And I remembered once I started doing it, how much I loved it and why it had been my first love. And I felt bad that I hadn't done it in so long. I'd certainly written and done a lot of nonfiction writing, but fiction is definitely my first love. And that's what brought me back to it.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I read somewhere that English was your background in college, correct?
It was, yes. I was an English lit major, which, I mean, if I could have just stayed, there were some things about college I didn't like, but if I could have just the rest of my life been in classes studying books, I think that would have been, I would have been happy. I really loved it.
And you apparently had taken one class where a professor promised to make the students
narratologists. Yes, yeah. Yes. That was so fascinating. She had us read a bunch of different books. We read Northanger Abbey, The French Lieutenant's Woman, The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, just books where narrators either inserted themselves into the story or that they were like, well, you know, sort of like in Northanger Abbey, there's nowhere for her to have a to meet a young gentleman, so I'm just going to put one in her path. You know, the narrator actually says that. It was so much fun. I mean, I just loved that class. It was fascinating. And I loved, I mean, and it wasn't a particular genre. It was all fiction, but it wasn't a particular, you know, romance or mystery, or, but it was all across, you know, current books, much older books, just fascinating.
Do you think that may have helped you develop your skills to create such strong character voices?
I don't know. You know, maybe. I think definitely for authors, just this is just my opinion, but I think reading a lot. I think that if you're I don't think you can be a good author, if I am a good author, but for anybody, if you don't love reading and you don't read a lot, because love of books and fiction, I think, is always at the root of it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Can you tell us a little bit about how your first book was actually published, the story behind that?
For The Siren of Sussex or for my...
I know, go way back.
Go way back, okay. So I didn't sell anything when I was young. Those books went out on submission with my agent, Helen McGrath, a wonderful, wonderful lady, but they didn't sell. They were young adult fiction. But then when I came back to writing, I wrote a book, I signed with an agent, and she said, you need a... online presence, which really honestly freaked me out because I didn't want to do anything virtual, Facebook, nothing. I always have avoided that. But I started a blog where I wrote a lot of nonfiction history posts, animal history, and just quirky things I found during my writing research, which seemed fascinating or amusing to me. And I was approached pretty early on, I think in maybe 2016 by Pen and Sword Books in England, who asked me if I wanted to write some nonfiction books for them. So I actually wrote two for them. And so that's a little bit how that happened. It was sort of unconventional. I hadn't hadn't any idea of writing something nonfiction. So I ended up sort of putting all my animal history research stories together. And that was The Pug Who Bit Napoleon, which was just a 18th and 19th century animal tales. But the big one was my fashion history book, which was just all of my research on Victorian fashion, which I'll tell you has helped me immensely. If ever I forget anything, I just use that to go back and look up something for my novels. But that was how it started initially.
They're both fascinating books. Stories to tell in them. Let's go ahead and leap forward and let's talk about your new book. What can you tell us about The Siren of Sussex?
The Siren of Sussex is set in Victorian London primarily, and it is about a Sussex-born country girl, Evelyn Maltravers, who, owing to her family's failing circumstances, you know, they don't have a lot of money. There is no man in the family to sort of make the way for them. They're really reliant on one of the daughters marrying well. So after a scandal with her older sister, Evelyn takes it upon herself, goes to London to have her first season, but she knows she's not going to make a splash in a ballroom. She's not traditionally beautiful. She's not particularly skilled at the more feminine arts, you know, standing on her own two legs, but she's really skilled on horseback and not just a good rider, but it's almost an art to her. She's incredibly skilled on horseback. So that's her plan, to make a splash in Rotten Row, where the ladies of the day would come and ride. Well, all the people would come and ride during the fashionable hour. So she decides to enlist a up-and-coming habit maker who's been designing really daring riding habits for the Victorian courtesans, the pretty horse breakers who rode in Rotten Row. And that's Ahmed Malik, a half Indian tailor. And she approaches him to make her a habit. And the two of them end up becoming friends and eventually more. And that's sort of how the romance begins. I'm afraid to give too much away. I don't know how much I should give away.
Now, I think one thing that it might be interesting to talk a little bit about for those who don't read a lot of historical fiction or historical romances, Evelyn is really focused on securing a good marriage. And that was important because women didn't have a lot of options at that time.
Right.
That was how, can you talk a little bit about why the whole season and marriage search for a husband was important?
Right. Women didn't have a lot, like you say, they didn't have a lot of options as far as If they were a gentlewoman, especially if they were working class, they had a little more freedom, not as much luxury, but more freedom. But for a gentlewoman, she couldn't really get a job. You know, there wasn't much she could do where she could earn any types of money. And so marrying well and having a husband who could take care of her and sort of secure her future was a really big part of their lives. And sort of the emphasis for a lot of gentlewomen was on getting married, you know, finding the best match, somebody who was wealthy and who hopefully was also somebody nice. But going to London during the season was a way for young women. They would do sort of the social scene, going to balls, various parties and dinners and picnics in the park, just to meet somebody to marry and hopefully get married in their first season, because the season was expensive for their family to afford. And gentlemen were the same, you know, if somebody was looking for a wife, he would also go and take part of the season and sort of look around, and not like he had his pick of everyone. I mean, it mattered too, who he was and how much money he had and his reputation, all those things were important. So it really was, they call it the marriage mart. It really was for men and for women, but there was a lot of emphasis on how wealthy you were, and for young women, what their dowry was, how much money they would bring, you know, if they were an heiress, and for men, how much money they had and what property they had.
Now, your heroine Evelyn has two passions, as you mentioned, in life: horseback riding and fashion. Are these perhaps things she inherited from her creator, or?
Yes, definitely. She definitely, especially the horses. I'm a huge animal lover, a huge horse lover, and Evelyn rides dressage. It may have been referred to that maybe once in the story, but the high school movement she does on her horse, the piaffe and passage, that's upper level dressage. And I've been riding dressage since I was very young. I got my first horse at 6, and my Andalusian dressage horse, Centeio, I got him when he was 2, and I had him until he was, 21. Okay. He passed away in February, but he advanced, not with me, because once I hurt my neck, my trainer rode him, but advanced all the way up to the pre-St. George level of dressage, which is just a few levels below Grand Prix. So yes, huge passion of mine. And when it's your passion, I had somebody ask once, doesn't Evelyn have other hobbies? When dressage is your passion, that's sort of consuming. I mean, it takes a lot of your focus. It takes a lot of your time. I mean, it's a really consuming passion. So that's what I wanted to give to Evelyn, that this was her sport. You know, she's an athlete, maybe Victorian, maybe wearing, you know, a fancy gowns and big, you know, riding habits with huge skirts, but she's an athlete.
What is it about the Victorian era, because you've written other books set during that time period, that fascinates you the most as a writer?
I think aside from just the superficial beauty of the fashion and customs and manners as a writer, it's because it was an era of so much change. And I see all that change happening that reminds me a little bit of our modern world, you know, just all of these huge technological changes that we deal with. And back then, you know, the changes in medicine and science and technology in, you know, for instance, if you were a rural village and suddenly a train comes through and you can get to London in a fraction of the time that you could have ever gone before, the way that it causes tension in their lives. I mean, it is, these are positive changes, but they are sort of, it's like an earthquake underneath them. You know, how do they find their footing? And how do they accept the changes? Some people didn't want to, or, you know, just how do they cope with these? And it's also a matter of the shifting in class, you know, tradesmen becoming wealthy, you know, just all the different things that were happening. And I just find writing characters who have to deal with all those changes is very interesting to me. And I hope interesting to readers, but it's interesting to me.
No, your books are fascinating. What I think you kind of bring out in this little part of the discussion is just what a broad range the Victorian period encompasses, because I think one of the common misperceptions, and I had this misperception, was you think of it as just being monolithic, but it's 60 years of...
It's a very long period of time.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite resources when it comes to researching books you set in the Victorian era? Do you go to primary sources? Do you look in museum collections? How do you go about researching? Maybe in the case of the Siren of Sussex.
So for Siren, luckily I had a lot of sort of banked fashion information from all of my previous research, but I really like to look at original sources, sort of magazines of the era, books of the era. There were a lot of etiquette manuals. There were a lot of descriptions of clothes sort of in the English Woman's Domestic magazine, or even in the American, sort of the American equivalent, Godey's Ladies book. But there are lots of magazines, lots of plates. The Met Museum has a great collection of historical fashion plates. And you can go through and you can look, especially at the ones from France, because at the time, the 1860s, when my story is set, France was really setting the standard of fashion, and everybody else sort of followed in a sense, you know, in some version or other, it sort of was handed down from Empress Eugenie, whatever she was wearing, whatever, you know, her style was. But I love looking through those things. I love looking at old letters and just anything from the actual era. And I also find scholarship is really useful from places like the Victorian Web, which is an academic resource. And there's a lot of contributions from professors who really, I mean, drill down deep into information about the era. And they're a trustworthy source, which I feel is really important, because there's, you know, the web is so vast. You Google a question and something comes up, you don't know if that's accurate. And I prefer to be as accurate as possible. And I probably am a little nutty about it to an extent because I get so worried. I always tell people that I write sometimes, especially in my author's note, it's more like a defensive brief than a novel because I just want to make sure I get it as accurate as possible.
Now, speaking of research, I love when I discover new things while reading a novel. And you mentioned before The Pretty Horse Breakers. Can you tell us a little bit more about that group of women?
Sure. They were at the time called the Pretty Horse Breakers, but then it was also just a name used for anybody who was writing and a little bit scandalous, but a really good writer. But it sort of originated with a courtesan named Catherine Walters. She was popularly known as Skittles because she started her career working in a bowling alley, but she was an excellent writer. She was a very popular courtesan. She was rumored to even at one point have been kept by royalty. She was the longtime mistress of the heir to the Duke of Devonshire, but very well-to-do. And she would ride during the fashionable hour most days in a very form-fitting riding habit and was so skilled on horseback. And when the other courtesans, there were a couple others, would ride also, they would really draw a crowd. And when I was researching for Siren, in fact, the little spark, one of the sparks that set off the story was something I read, a sort of mock satirical letter complaining about what are the well-to-do daughters to do? You know, how are they to find husbands when all of these eligible young men are only interested in sort of gaping at the pretty horse breakers? And how could a young lady draw attention to herself? But they were really dramatic and fascinating to watch. And I think also the air of scandal attached to them probably made them even more interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. But as a result, some young ladies sort of tried to, you know, copy their styles, to even copy their language and phrases, their horsey, you know, horse girl phrases. But I think that's such an interesting phenomenon. But Catherine Walters even inspired paintings, lots of things. She was very famous during the era. And even there was a court case where she didn't pay her tailors. And when she, another time she left for America and everybody was talking about how her departure was lamented by the city because they wouldn't see her anymore. But yeah, lots of fascinating history attached to them.
One of the other kind of minor threads that's pulled into the story in Siren is spiritualism. And that was fascinating too. I think you mentioned, and I'm probably not going to get his name right, Zagkel?
You know, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly either. I think you're about right. I think Zadkiel. But yeah, an ex-soldier who wrote an astrological almanac and was rumored to, I mean, he made a lot of predictions. I guess it's that scattershot kind of prediction where one inevitably will be true because you make so many. But he was said to have predicted the death of Prince Albert, which made him a little more respected. But I did like to have him in the story and also this crystal ball that he was said to have owned, because I'd written about the history of this crystal ball before, not in my nonfiction articles, that was supposed to have been from an Egyptian magi and passed down, and the different famous society figures who had owned it and all the spooky things attributed to it, and that it ultimately was something he owned and he would exhibit it at society events. And I thought that was just really fascinating. And especially the spiritualist fascinated me because it was a way of class mixing. You know, it sort of cut across the class divide, because anybody who had any interest in it or any skills in that area, you know, somebody who was a medium or somebody who was a skilled crystal gazer or water gazer would be at these events. And it was a way for me to allow Evelyn and Ahmed to be together when normally it, you know, a sort of fancy, you know, Victorian society party, there's not really a realistic, believable way that a tailor would be at this party, especially if he was a mixed race tailor. But with the spiritualist sort of thing running through it, and some spiritualist gatherings in society were more penetrable, let's say.
Now, in addition to your many novels, you mentioned you've written two nonfiction books, one about animals and one about fashion. Can you tell us a little bit about The Pug Who Bit Napoleon and A Victorian Lady's Guide to Fashion and Beauty?
Sure. Both were published by Pen and Sword in England. And The Pug Who Bit Napoleon is really a collection of quirky historical animal tales. A lot of them I had originally wrote as shorter articles on my author blog quite a few years ago. And so there's stories about not just dogs, but cats, goats, alligators, foxes, just pretty much every animal you could imagine, and historical tales about them, which I thought were lots of fun to research because I'm such a big animal lover. Mm-hmm. And A Victorian Lady's Guide to Fashion Beauty, less quirky, but it's just an overview of the changing silhouettes from the time I started, the 1840s, so just a few years after Queen Victoria took the throne, and then at the end, 1901, and talk about the changing shape of dresses as it goes to sort of, you know, the full skirts to the bustle, and then to the tailor-made gowns at the end of the century, and also about accessories and styles of hairstyles and styles of jewelry. So it's sort of an overview of everything with a lot of specific examples, but as much as you can overview an era in the amount of pages my publisher said I had to write, which I think it was 60,000 words was my limit. So trying to cram in that huge amount of information as best I could.
Well, you really, for anyone who's interested in the history of the era or writing, you provide a lot of fascinating details, both in your books and through your website. I mean, things like the fact that Victorians were obsessed about eyebrows. I mean,
That was a recent thing that I found, just about, you know, them attributing certain characteristics of your personality to the shape of your eyebrows, just things like that, which are so quirky and weird. I find them really interesting and amusing. So I love sharing that sort of information that I find in my research.
What does your writing process look like, or do you have a process, and does it differ when you're writing a novel or when you're writing nonfiction?
It's definitely different. For nonfiction, my writing is more structured, but you know, I'm more likely to have an outline of these are sort of the topics, because I'm trying to cram a certain amount of information in a certain word limit. But for fiction, I guess you call it a panster, seat of your pants writing. Mm-hmm. I have an idea when I start, sort of broad overview, and I have some specific ideas just in my head. I don't write an outline. And I just start writing. And a lot of times the story takes a few turns as I'm writing, which means I have to stop and research new things. Mm-hmm. But eventually I find my way to the end and I revise as I go. So usually as I'm revising as I go, by the time I'm done, I have the finished draft to send to my editor. And it always feels impossible when I start. I always feel like, how am I gonna do this? I feel overwhelmed. But once I'm about 10,000 words in, I feel more confident that I can actually do it. And I remind myself it's not the first time I've done it. So I feel like I know that I can do it. And it just takes a little bit before me to gain my confidence.
Now, you are a hybrid author. So for those of us, those listening in, who aren't familiar with that, can you explain a little bit about what that is and why does it work for you as an author?
Sure. Hybrid just means that some of my books are traditionally published, which is with an actual publisher. Mm-hmm. And some of my books are independently published, which would be self-published. And the reason that works for me is just because it gives me a lot of flexibility. And for example, for my, they call them indie books, but self-published books, I'm able to keep the ebook rights or the paperback rights, and then my agent will sell just the subsidiary rights, like the audio or foreign translations or large print, those sort of things. And there's sort of a financial benefit when you keep your rights as an indie, you get a higher royalty rate, but also it allows you to write at your own pace. You're not committed to a schedule. I mean, you are, if you promise your readers to this book will be out at a certain time, you try to have it out at that certain time. But for me, because of my health issues, my neck issues, I grapple with every day what my level of pain is. And for the indie books, I don't feel obligated if I'm having a high pain day to write as much that day or to write at all, because mm-hmm. I'm sort of my own boss. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's worked for me. For my traditionally published books, the schedule is more generally more set in stone. Like, we need these things by these times. And, you know, you feel you're obligated just, you know, as a responsible person, but also contractually obligated mm-hmm. to meet these markers. And if you're somebody with a disability, sometimes that's a little bit more of a challenge. Yeah. So that's why I like to have a mix. And I hope going forward, I'll continue to have a mix. But we'll see what happens.
Now, since you've been writing for a while, if you have the ability, what is one thing about the publishing business you would change as an author?
You know, I think that for traditional, I would probably want it to move a little more quickly. It's very slow, like mm-hmm. notoriously slow. But I say that, and then on the other hand, because of various things that have happened recently, I had to ask for extensions. So it wouldn't help me if it moved more quickly. So that's probably it. I mean, overall, my experience has been very positive. There's definitely hard parts or frustrating parts or parts, you know, where you accidentally read a bad review that's very hurtful and you think, well, I wish I never, but all of that is, you can deal with all of that. There are ways to deal with all of that. So yeah, aside from the slowness, I think that I'm okay with most of it, actually.
Now let's switch gears a little bit. I know many authors are also readers. What have you read this year that you'd like to share with other readers?
Oh gosh, a lot of things. So yeah. I was really lucky. I've mentioned this before, but I was really on many other interviews, but I can't sing its praises highly enough. I read Stephanie Barron's newest Jane Austen mystery.
Oh my God, isn't it? She's wonderful.
So good. I loved it. Jane in the Year Without a Summer. Mm-hmm. That was just amazing. It was amazing. And I believe it comes out in February.
It does. She's coming to the Poison Pen.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Big fan of her writing. It feels like you're reading something truly from that era, which is the highest compliment I could possibly give. But yeah, a great book and she's just such a nice person mm-hmm. too. I also read Meg Tilly's Runaway Heiress, which was very exciting. I like a book that with suspense that will keep me turning the pages. And, you know, just like you can't read fast enough trying mm-hmm. to figure out what happens. I've also, really anticipating Harper St. George's new book in her Gilded Age Heiresses series. And I believe it's called The Lady Tempson Heir. That's going to be out in February. I didn't get an advance copy of that, but mm-hmm. I read the first two in the series and really enjoyed them. Let's see. I read a book there's an author named Jane Frasina, who I'm a big fan of. She was traditionally published mm-hmm. and now is published at a smaller publisher, but her books are like quirky Victorian, accurate Victorian, but quirky romances. Sometimes a ghost appears, sometimes time travel appears, but she had a Christmas book called The Snowbirds, which I really enjoyed. Mm. But yeah, so many books. There's just so many good ones and not enough time.
Now are you looking, I don't know if you've heard about the new HBO show, Gilded?
I saw the preview for it. It looks mm. like it's going to be amazing,
yeah.
But I don't know anything about it outside of that preview. But that was enough almost to make you want to watch it.
I've also read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that The Great Gatsby is one of your favorite books.
I do love The Great Gatsby, and primarily because I think the writing is so beautiful, and the way he turns a phrase and some of the sentiments he expresses, the feeling of our relationship to the past, it just really strikes a chord with me. But yeah, I love that novel.
Are you looking forward to the centennial in 3 years?
Oh my gosh. Do you think that means there's going to be a ton of, I don't know if it's is it now going out of copyright, or is it about to go out of copyright?
It's in the process. So I know there's publishers who are releasing editions that couldn't before, but it seems like there's also a renewed interest in other authors looking at it and kind of using it as a springboard for.
Yes. Yeah. It makes me interested to know what's coming on that front, you know, how it will transform. But it's hard to believe that so many years have passed since then.
Yeah.
Because the themes still feel so relevant to me.
Now, what's next for you as an author? I think there's a couple more books in the Siren kind of.
Yes, screen. There are. So the second book is already written and ready to go. It's The Belle of Belgrave Square, and it will be out in October with Berkeley Romance. And then the third book, which is the book I'm writing right now, there's going to be a longer gap before it comes out. It'll be out in fall of 2023. Gosh, I can't believe 2023. I still think we're in 2019. Mm-hmm. The time has passed so quickly.
Yeah, passes quickly and it seems to stand still at the same time.
It does, yeah.
Now, how can readers learn more about your books? You have a website, don't you?
I do, mimimatthews.com. There's lots of information there about my books. And there is also, the tab is called Extras, or what is it called? Yeah, just Extras. And you can link down to that and it'll show you lots of additional information about the 19th century, specifically the Victorian era, tons of information about fashion and beauty and animals and the law, lots of resources. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter at Mimi Matthews Esquire, just ESQ, and on Facebook at Mimi Matthews Author.
Oh, so you are busy. I can't believe our time has gone by so quickly.
It's just been
a delight talking to Mimi Matthews, whose new book is The Siren of Sussex. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with before we have to log off?
Just that it's been so nice talking to you, and I hope to come back again someday.
We would love to have you back, and that's Mimi Matthews, whose new book is The Siren of Sussex. I'd like to thank her for taking time to visit with The Poison Pen virtually, and for all of you tuning in and listening, thank you. This has been another virtual author chat at The Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.